Well, thank you for everyone that's been with me all today. This is talk four, for some people. This is kind of a different style format. So if you're expecting a lot of slides and a lot of demos, this is probably not the talk for you. It's instead what I call an unplugged format. So in other words, I don't actually have a fixed prepared presentation. Instead, I'm going to create one on the fly with you, which usually goes pretty well, but it does require a lot of audience participation, because if you're just silent and stare at me, I'm just going to be silent and stare back, and it's going to be a really long hour for both of us. So we're done with slides. The format I like to usually use with these things is Notepad, again, it's kind of a question and answer session, so I can drop down and show code and show demos and walk through things, but generally what I usually like to do as a format is open it up to questions from the audience, try to get as many questions as possible of any set of topics, and then we'll spend like 30 seconds moving the topics around into some logical sequence, and then I basically spend the remaining hour trying to answer all the questions and hopefully create a talk that's sort of interesting, touches on a couple different topics. So with that, who has a question? We'll spend about 5 minutes, 7 minutes just putting this list of questions together. Yeah. FC4? Oh, NBC4. Release date. Good question. So what I'm going to do is write these questions down, and then we'll put all the ones that are NBC-related together and all the Azure ones and things like that. Yeah?
Two questions. The first question is, in the moment ago you showed us about the minifier, but what I'm interested also in is how will it show in client-side debugging?
Oh, okay. Minification and debug. Okay.
And the second question I have is, you showed us about the last part of your presentation just a moment ago about the web API. And you showed us that the status created comeback, but how does it work on, for example, you put the requirement attribute on the name of a model, and how is that these things are validated? For example, you have two kinds of validation. One is really strict. The second one is just a warning. How do you handle things like that? With
Excellent question. Yeah, okay, I cover those. Yep. I probably don't need a microphone because I'm just going to type the question kind of summary there. Okay. Azure Appliance? Custom display modes and layouts, how to extend. Excellent. Yeah? Good questions.
Ben was mentioning something about a new update for the phone, but he couldn't tell something about it. Or in chain of commands, you're a bit higher. So tell us something about after Mango.
Okay.
That for jQuery integration, especially with Ajax, for example, if you use jQuery and update panels that don't really work fine together.
Cool.
So my practical questions, printing from Azure, from a local printer. How do I deploy multiple websites into a single web role? How do I deploy Windows servers to a web role?
Deploy, what was it?
Deploy Windows servers to a web role.
Okay. Well, let me ask that.
Can you elaborate a little bit more about the strategy for workflow?
Yeah. Cool.
When you're hosting a web service in Azure, you want to call another web service.
Okay.
What will the future of Silverlight be?
Okay.
Next.
Yeah. What does the future of the world look like? I will pontificate on what I think it is, but that one might be a little bit more imprecise. But let me see recipes. How do they taste? What the heck are they? Cool.
Also for minification, how do you take care of the priority of the task?
Cool.
And if you use language resource files within Razor, it's possible use it in your CSHTML file, but if you go into a Java scripting file and you want to use there your resource.
Okay. Oh, CSS sprites.
Yes, CSS sprites. Is there any future in that?
Yeah. Sprites. Yep. web pages and MVC. MVC, which to use, you said?
Yeah.
Oh. Cool. Look at maybe two more, and then we'll get going so that we don't just spend the whole hour writing them down. It should be easy for me, but it might suck for you. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Okay. Well, tell you what, I'm gonna put some of these questions together, so we'll do a couple of. So we'll move the Azure ones in one place. Couple of the ASP.NET ones first. So what I'm going to do is just break them down into sections so that we can try to hit a couple of them that are kind of related, so we're not constantly bouncing around. And then, but feel free to ask more questions along the way. But we'll do sort of ASP.NET set of questions first, and so ask more there, and then ideally, and then Azure, and Silverlight. Keep moving that one down. Okay. Tell you what, let's do this one here because it's sort of Azure related. Okay, well, we're going to try to get through all of them, but let's also just within here, let's get a couple of the Web API ones out of the way. Minification together. Okay. There we go. Okay. So anyway, this will help me kind of organize the talk a little bit more. So starting from the top, and we'll just kind of go through it. And so I'm going to basically kind of riff on each of these sections. Again, feel free to ask clarifying questions. Also feel free to ask more questions in that area if you have them. So in terms of the MVC 4 release date, I mentioned the beta is available today, so you can download that immediately. The final MVC 4 release date, we don't actually have a published date. I'd say we're driving towards early summer, mostly based on feedback. So if people have a lot of feedback on stuff they don't like, it might be midsummer. If everyone says, hey, it's perfect, then it's tomorrow. Basically kind of our rough time frame is probably the summer time frame for the MVC 4 release date. It does have a go-live license, so if you do want to start using it now, you can. As I mentioned in the talk, there's no server-side install. It's all bin deployed. So basically, if you create a project and then just upload it to a machine that has .NET 4 on it, it should just work. So you don't need your hoster to install anything. You don't need your server admin to install anything. You don't even have to tell your server admin that you're running beta software. But that's up to you. And so roughly we're thinking kind of the summer time frame is what we're targeting. It doesn't have any dependencies on .NET 4.5, so that's why we can ship it independently of even VS 11. So that's why we ship the beta sooner. But it will also be included in VS 11 and .NET 4.5 when they ship as well. A couple other questions people had were about web APIs and URL conventions. So how do those work? So for example, when I created that red shirt project, is Redshirt 4 for accounting. A few people are wondering, so, hey, you built this and it was /API/products. Does it have to be /API? Could I have the prefix be something else? Could it just be a top-level URL? The answer to all those things is yes. We do have conventions in the box by default. By default, we kind of use /API/controller name. As the convention, but it's all configurable. And it works pretty much the same as routes do today in MVC. So if you go to your global.asax file, there is a register routes section. One thing that's different is because we sometimes see people wanting to have different defaults for web APIs versus HTML-based controllers. We basically have a map HTTP route and a map route. This is what we've always shipped here, and this uses the kind of controller action ID approach. This one here basically uses kind of a API controller-based approach. It, by default, does not surface the action name in the URI. But if you want to change that, that's where you change it. You can change any default parameters. You can customize it however you want. We don't enforce any URL convention, but our default is REST-based. We kind of use good REST parameters and formats here. Does that answer the question there in terms of that? How did it find the controller? So basically, by default, if something comes in with a /API prefix here, we basically look at the next part of the URI to indicate the controller name. And so in this case here, the controller was products controller, and that's how we resolved it. It was in the API's namespace, yeah. Because it's an API controller, it resolved against the products controller that derives from API controller. If you wanted to be explicit, I think one of the defaults you can specify is the namespace priority to look at. And you can do that today with standard controllers as well. I happen to use products controller in two places, that's why I used folders to separate them out. So I said, this is my products controller, it's an API. This is my products controller, which is for HTML. I thought was kind of more convenient. We're kind of looking for feedback during the beta. Like, I actually sent mail to the team late they were really looking forward to that mail, where I said, hey, I wonder if we should have an APIs folder by default as a convention, because we have a /API prefix by default. And so we are probably going to, for the RC, enable an add controller action. Here right now, you have to do new item in order to add an API controller. If you go in the controllers folder with the beta and say add controller, you'll notice in the dropdown there's now an empty API controller, an empty API controller with read-write actions, and we're likely to have a scaffolded against Entity Framework, so that if you want to create a RESTful API on top of a data model, we can easily generate that for you as well. This is all just populated with T4 templates, so you can also plug in your own custom ones and get them through GNU-get. And again, you know, the kind of from an approach we're taking, we're trying to make sure that we don't force you into any particular URI convention, because when we scan all the different web APIs on the web, there's a variety of different formats, and I'd say in general the industry is still evolving, and so the common conventions people will use 3 years from now is probably different than what they are today. And so we're trying to make sure we have a, you know, that's why we called it, instead of REST controller, we actually call it API controller, is because we don't think it's tied specifically to REST, but at the same time we're making sure that it works great with REST. And so the default convention, again, you can override it, is if there's a GET method, we use that to process GET requests. If there's a POST method, we use it to process POST requests. Can you guess what we do with the DELETE method? DELETE requests. So so by default, you can do that. If you want to, you can also go ahead and just say, like, GET FUBAR or GET PRODUCT. And if you want to name it that way, you can do it as well. Again, it's convention. You can override it, but... in VB, I think you can't say get because it's actually a keyword. And so in VB, typically you'd say get product. And that convention's baked in by default as well. So you can do get or get product, whatever feels most natural to you. But if you want to call this get, you know, if you want to call this Bob, you could also do that, and then you could just say add a HTTP get attribute, and that would allow you to specify call this method when a get comes in. And that's the same convention that we use inside MVC controllers today as well. Standard controllers. Let me just change that before I forget and wonder why it didn't work. Yeah?
Is this actually WebAPIs?
Good question. I didn't actually talk about it in the talk. I should have actually mentioned that. One of the things that we did, historically, I actually didn't used to manage the WCF team or the workflow team, and a lot of the server pieces of .NET. And so we did kind of a couple changes this summer where I kind of took on Azure as well as the server side, all the server side pieces of .NET. I always managed ASP.NET, but not the others. And so one of the things we did was kind of merge the teams together. And one of the things we realized pretty quickly was like, oh, we're on track to build multiple ways to build REST APIs. And judging on the comments, people ask, which do I use, this or this or this? People don't necessarily like having five options. Let's put the teams together and have one. And so there's a great project called the WCF REST API, or WCF API project, or Web API project. And so what we did was we actually merged them with the ASP.NET MVC team. And so they actually built this and integrated it. And the goal is to have all the benefits of the WCF web API. And so I think it has all the features that it had, including the ability to host it in a command line console app or an NT service, but at the same time integrate it nicely with MVC. So if there was a convention like routing that MVC already had, rather than have a completely different API to do it, we actually, if you look side by side, they look pretty much the same. Validation web APIs, how do those work? And so that's a good question. So for example, let's say when I post a product, and if you remember on a product we said name is required, what happens if you don't specify the name? So one of the things we did, again, as part of kind of the integration with ASP.NET, is we allow you to use the same validation attributes that you can use elsewhere in ASP.NET with the web APIs. There's actually a helper that you can, and well, actually, let me step back. One of the things that we've actually gone back and forth on is, do we do the validation before we call your method, or do we pass you an object and let you explicitly check validation and throw your own custom errors? And we support both mechanisms, and we're trying to decide what the default is. So it's one thing we're trying to get feedback on for the beta, is if I send in a payload that is missing name, should we throw the exception before we call you, or do you get a chance to throw it? With the beta, what you can do is you can say if model.isValid. If modelState.isValid, which is the same way you do it with standard controllers. You can say throw new HTTP exception. You are a terrible person. Oh, yeah, it's true. Well, you could do this if you wanted to have a really funky API. Good point, though. But you could, for example, throw an HTTP exception, and that'll just work. Or what you can do is, if you want even more explicit, you could go ahead and just return an HTTP response method message. You know, for example, if you wanted to, you could, you know, you basically specify any custom properties you wanted on that. Oops, turn new. And there's a bunch of properties on that if you want to set custom headers or formats or things like that. I think we'll probably, my kind of current thinking is, rather than require you to do this, actually have it by default before we call you. Because with web APIs, if it's truly malformed in you're missing property syntax set, you probably just want the system to do it for you. In the beta, you can explicitly check if it's valid. And this will run all of the model validations that you have. So if you have range validations or use any of the data annotation attributes, we'll enforce all those and give you friendly error messages for it back. So it's pretty easy to enforce. And again, it allows you to kind of do your validation once and enforce it consistently everywhere, which is kind of nice. So that's a little bit about that. Questions on minification and the priority order of files. One of the things I showed when I showed the minification demo was how you can have multiple files in a directory. So I could, for example, reference my CSS folder and just say /content/CSS. And I could basically have a reset.css and a site.css, and they'd be merged together. The question here was a good question, which is the order kind of matters, because if you actually use reset at the very end, you've just cleared out all of your CSS settings. And so when you merge the two files together, which comes first, reset or sites? By default, we actually have some smart conventions based on naming. So since reset.css is a pretty common convention that web designers use, if you have a reset.css file in the bundle, we actually put that at the top of the bundle, and then we process the rest of the requests. And if I have a blog post you can go to somewhere here called New Bundling and Minification Support, and I actually list once upon a time the order. So by default, this would be the order. We do jQuery first, then jQuery UI, and then your custom scripts, and then we'll do reset, content, forms, globals, menu, styles in that order by default. So you can basically have a smart conventions. So you don't have to specify it. If you want to override it, though, you can just go in your global.sax file and just wire up a custom rule. And so then you could put them in whatever order you want. And so if you want to go to definition at the top, great, just rearrange them. And we'll bundle in that order. But hopefully out of the box, you get kind of smart default bundling rules. Minification and debugging. So can you still debug minified code? The answer is yes. By default, you will be debugging the minified code. So that's good, because it's going to be exactly what the browser will do at runtime. But if you're looking for like a really easy way, you can just map that back to the original source. You'll probably want to turn off minification while you're trying to debug that particular problem. And so it is possible to turn off minification. You could also, if you wanted to, inside your global.sax, have rules where if you said, oh, if running in debug mode, disable minification. Because it's code, you can basically wire up whatever rules you want. And you'll notice that by default, we have something called enable default bundles. So if you want to turn off minification entirely or turn off the default rules, you just comment out that one line, and away you go. I should also mention all the minification logic can be overridden. So, for example, when you say new bundle, you get to specify what minifier you want to use. So in this case here, I'm using the JS minifier. Here, right, specified I wanted to use the less minifier and the coffee minifier. These were actually just classes in my project, and so this is what coffee minifier looks like. It derives from JS minifier and then just overrides the process to do coffee script compilation before the base approach. And so if you want to do whatever custom wacky rule you want for minification or compression, you can do that, and it's pretty easy to plug in and extend. And the key thing here is you no longer have to do build steps. It just kind of works by default and hopefully makes life a lot easier and your apps a lot faster. Question here was custom display modes and layouts. How does that work? So in my talk today, I showed how you could have a .mobile template, and we can detect whether it's a mobile device or not and then use that appropriately. And I think the question was, could I extend it to be Android, or could I extend it to be iOS specific? How does that work? It's a good question. I've actually never done that. But so let's make it up. What I can show you, though, is a sample that someone else sent me. I didn't actually include in my talk, but I can actually show you the code. Basically, inside your global.sax, and this code format's a little weird, but let me rewrite this because it's annoying me. So I could say var mode equals this, just to make it a tiny bit simpler, and then that. I don't know why I did it at zero, but anyway, this is some code that someone wrote. Basically, this is registering a custom WinPhone display mode that he's built. And so basically, he's given a name WinPhone. And then basically, he's saying the context is if the user agent contains Windows Phone OS, this display mode will be used. And he's basically adding it to the beginning of the list of modes. And so the default mode is sort of default and mobile. He's adding a new override that'll be looked at first before the mobile template in case a Windows Phone's being used. And so you could imagine taking the syntax and having iOS-specific extensions. And because it's code, you should be, in theory, able to access anything in the request object to determine whether or not to use a mode. So you could even use a cookie. You could use a IP address. You could use whatever you want in order to display. And then once you have this rule set up, you can just create .winphone overrides at any layer in your views folder. And then if a Windows Phone comes in, we'll use that override. That makes sense? So it's a pretty clean way that you can override. And again, you can override at different levels. So for example, he's overridden here the index view, but he didn't override the about and the contact view. And so it gives you kind of a nice way that as you kind of start to more mobile optimize your site, typically I see people or, you know, I envision people wanting to override their layout file first because that's the thing that applies everywhere and then try to reuse their existing views within it. But use the layout file to, for example, size it to be appropriate to a screen that's the right size, remove some heading and footing to make it fit above the fold better on a small screen, and then try to reuse their views inside their view folders as much as possible. But with this mechanism, you can go as deep as you want. And I don't know if he has done it. He hasn't. But you could even, at the partial template level, so like effectively a user control included in views, you could override it at that level too. So it's a pretty powerful mechanism. And pretty flexible. MVC recipes. So a lot of people noticed, hey, when you hit add controller, there's this cool run recipe, and when you run it, it lets you select from a list of it that's empty. This is a feature that is going to disappear and then reappear in a better state. Basically, we have a pretty cool extensibility mechanism that we've built, which allow you, it's kind of like T4 templates, but they actually can apply towards the entire project. And so our goal behind here is that you could do custom scaffolding this way, you could do localization scripts this way, you could do whatever you want through this mechanism. We built it and then decided to prioritize a few features higher than this, and so it's functional, and the actual implementation works, but we didn't have time to actually write a bunch of cool recipes. And the other thing that we kind of realized is we don't really want to tie this to MVC. We are actually going to put it in NuGet so that it applies to all .NET projects. And so you're going to see very much similar UI, But instead of being MVC specific, it'll show up in the next release of NuGet, and hopefully there'll be lots of things in this list that you can take advantage of. So ignore it for right now. But it is very cool. And basically it allows you to do automation within your project and your solution. We expect to kind of ship a lot of cool extensibility options this way, and you'll be able to install them via NuGet, so you can create your own scripts as well and share them with the web. But it was clever that you actually noticed that. Other quick questions on ASP.NET before we get to Azure. Localization of client-side resources. I think Scott Hanselman has a really good blog post on this. I didn't actually read it, but I'm told it's wonderful. And because someone else asked me this question before. Partly because I had to confess, I build localized server products, but I've never built a localized JavaScript product. My team has, but I've never actually done it. So I will defer to you to his post, because I think he actually did a lot of research on it, and I'm told it's really good. And so I could make something up, but I'll point you at his post, because I think he probably has a better answer. Sprites in ASP.NET, we do... 99% sure sprites are built into ASP.NET 4.5. And I did do a blog post on it about a year ago. And I don't think it's changed. So it should be part of the new framework. And so, yeah, we do have a sprite framework that's shipping. And it basically, the benefit of sprites is it allows you to put a lot of images in a directory. And similar to the bundling and minification, it basically merges the images into what's called a sprite, which is a single file that gets downloaded. And then you can use CSS offsets to actually indicate which part of the image you want to show. And the benefit there is you're downloading less files, they can be compacted together, and performance can be better. So that it works similar to bundling minification. I didn't talk about it today, but I will probably throw it into the next version of this talk because it's a pretty cool feature. Web pages, MVC, and web forms, which to use? This is a good question a lot of people ask. And the answer is basically it depends to some extent on kind of, you know, what you're optimizing for and what your background is. From a simplicity perspective, or if like I was building a personal website, I would probably use web pages because I just need basic interactivity and I don't really need a fully architected site or application for it. And web pages is kind of designed to kind of be minimalistic, kind of be very scripting friendly. It uses Razor, so it's the same syntax you'd use inside MVC views. It's pretty quick and dirty. If I was building a giant enterprise app where I wanted to have testing, and increasingly if I want to do more interactivity with client-side back and forth, and so I want to have a lot of client-side script and a lot of back-end code, I'd probably use MVC. On the web forms front, I don't really want to care a lot about the HTML, and I really care about how do I get the functionality going, and I want to encapsulate the UI generation as much as possible with a control layer, I'd use web forms. So it's hard to say exactly. What we're trying to do is not have three distinct things, but wherever possible, share assets across them. And so, in fact, even though I called my talk MVC4, if you actually look at the list of stuff I did, you know, in some ways I lied and cheated, but you all bought into it, so it worked. But bundling minification will work in all three. Database migrations will work in all three. Web APIs will actually work in all three. Mobile web, that only works in MVC. But real-time communication will work in all three. Async will work in all three. It's an MVC talk, and there's lots of MVC goodness, but where possible, we've architected the things consciously so that you can use them elsewhere as well. And, you know, one of the things we even talk about is, like, do we get out of having file new MVC project, file new web forms project, file new web pages project? Do we just say file new ASP.NET project? And then you can choose, check, 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 which features you want, and you can basically build a solution that is a hybrid of all the features you want to do. So that's kind of directionally where we'd ideally like to go at some point. From a feature set perspective, the good news is the stuff I taught you today, you can use much of that, in fact, all but the mobile web piece. inside a WebForms project. In fact, Web APIs, in addition to hosting inside MVC, you'll be able to create an APIs folder inside WebForms projects as well. We're trying to kind of eliminate differences. And one of the reasons why we don't have a separate ASP.NET and WCF way to build HTTP-based web APIs is we're also trying to be conscious not to provide lots of choices internally that you then need to decipher, instead be a little bit more coherent across those different pieces. So I don't know if that was a decent answer or not. But jQuery and ASP update panels. I think the question was, there's some issues where you want to use jQuery with web forms, and sometimes you conflict, or it's hard. The integration points aren't always easy. Good news is we're making that a lot simpler with the new release of ASP.NET Web Forms. It's coming out as part of 4.5. Send me specifics on the update panel one. I can hook you up with a member of the team to verify. But in general, what we're trying to do with all our Web Forms controls is make them a lot easier to use from jQuery. And so by default, we no longer do inline validation. Instead, we use jQuery validation. Where possible, we're using HTML5 appropriately. We don't use inline styles anymore. And we're trying to make sure that we have integration points and interception points throughout the controls that allow you to kind of easily style them with CSS as well as use client-side JavaScript against it. So I don't know the specifics of the update panel issue, but if you send me mail, hopefully we fixed it. That's certainly kind of from a thematic perspective, one of the things we're trying to invest in. Azure. Where to go with Azure? Lots of good questions. Database options. So I mentioned in my Azure talk, we have kind of three built-in storage mechanisms inside Azure today. Just bring that up soon. So we have blob storage, SQL Azure databases, and table storage. And so these are kind of managed services that you basically can rely on that we kind of manage. So we'll patch them, we make them clustered, we make them highly available, and we provide a distinct SLA or a service license agreement for each. So we guarantee 99.9% availability for each of those services, and if we don't, then you can ask for money back. The way to think about it a little bit is the first one is really about unstructured storage. You can store anything in a blob. It's like files on disk. You can put anything there. SQL Azure is more for relational storage, where you want to be able to enforce relationships and where you actually want to normalize data. And table storage is more of kind of a NoSQL-like option. Whether or not it's NoSQL or not depends on your definition. It does not do relational joins between tables. So you do kind of think of it in a key value tabular kind of way as opposed to kind of more of a relational way. So it's definitely a non-relational solution. It allows you to store hundreds of terabytes of data and scale with very known performance characteristics. So those are kind of the three built-in options in Azure today. One of the things that we are doing, and if you go to the Azure website now, you can start to see some tutorials on these showing up. So, for example, on the Node section, there's a tutorial on using Node with our built-in storage, but also if you want to build Node with MongoDB, we actually have a task that lets you install MongoDB and deploy it inside Azure inside a worker role. And we're going to have a .NET version of this tutorial show up, I think, in the next week or two as well. We are working on, as part of kind of our openness, how do we embrace existing data storage solutions and have tutorials and support on them natively within Azure. Expect more of that kind of in the rest of this year. So those are some of the sort of options that you can use today. Yeah.
And the customer calls and yesterday I tried to pay more, but it didn't work. It was like returning to the state of the database the day before.
Yeah, good question. Okay.
On your servers, on the cluster.
Well, there's there's two options. Like, one is if a customer for some reason has a problem. I mean, there's a way to instrument your app. So I'd probably say if a customer calls up with like a pay my order didn't arrive, I'd probably restore the database to a point in time as the last resort to try to figure out what happened. Hopefully you can instrument your app and figure out what went wrong. And there's a talk tomorrow from a guy named Karan Deep on my team who's specifically covering monitoring and diagnostics. I don't know if Karan's here, actually. No. But he's going to do a talk, monitoring diagnostics with Azure. And so I think he's going to cover some of those types of scenarios in terms of how do you diagnose when things are going wrong or when you have a problem in the app. Specifically, there's also a feature that we're going to enable with SQL Azure, which is effectively a point-in-time restore option, so that you can say, oh, recreate my database as of this moment in time over here, and it will actually generate that database for you with all the data in it at that precise second that you want to restore it. That's going to take a little while. It's not just it automatically works, because if you have a big database, it's going to take a while. But in the case where you have a disaster, you know, like you deployed code that started deleting rows randomly, you have some option to roll back and figure out. It doesn't solve the problem, but it at least makes your life a lot easier. And so that is a feature that's on our roadmap for SQL that we've talked about. Emailing from Azure, if you want to email things from Azure, this used to actually be hard. One of the things we did is partner with a company called SendGrid. They have an email service, and if you go to our website, we actually have a tutorial called How to Send Email Using SendGrid, or a tutorial. They've got a NuGet package. Basically, you stick some code in here, and away you go. And they do have a special Azure offer, and so if you go to their website, it's big. You can sign up now, and you get 25,000 free emails a month. Provides a pretty good way that you can do email send. They have some pretty big customers. Foursquare is one of their customers. So that it's not just vanilla email. They actually do analytics and tracking and a bunch of other features as well. And so there's now a tutorial that walks you through how to do that within Azure. I keep returning to the tutorials because this is kind of a pet peeve of mine, which is how do we have great tutorials? And so I actually sit down with the team for like 2 hours a week and actually review all the tutorials and suggest new ones. And so some of these ones, I'm glad you're asking because these are ones that I made them write. Keep sending us feedback on tutorials. We actually will have a commenting. We're going to use Discus so that you can actually add comments. And we basically deploy this 2 times a week update the content based on feedback and based on people's usage of it. Azure Appliance Plans. So one of the things we've talked about with Azure that's still very much on our roadmap is this concept we call an appliance. So I mentioned earlier today, we have 6 data centers around the world that we run, or 6 regions around the world that we run Azure in. Each region can actually have multiple data centers, but 6 kind of regions. 2 in Europe, 2 in North America, 2 in Asia. What we're also, and we'll actually have more data centers opening up later this, regions opening up later this year. But we're also looking to enable something we call the Azure Appliance, which is basically your own version of Azure that you can run in any data center you want. It's not a small thing. It's actually like 1,000 servers. So it's actually a fairly big thing. You don't just put it under your desk. But it's designed so that if you work for like a government agency or you work for a very large enterprise or you work for a solution integrator, solution provider, and you have multiple customers, you can actually have your own operations staff run the hardware and infrastructure and have complete isolation from other people. And so that will be an option that we'll be enabling in the future. And we expect, you know, most countries will end up having their own Azure appliances being run either by them or by other agencies or SIs. Printing from Azure. It's a good question. How would you print something from Azure? You don't plug in a printer to your server in Azure. But what you can do is you can use that Service Bus Relay feature that I showed in my talk this afternoon so that you could basically have a printing unit that connects up into Azure, and then when your app wants to print, it fires either something into a queue or a relay message, and basically your app could basically take the message and print. And so there's actually a couple pretty cool ISVs that are doing stuff with it. There's Scott Cate. He's going to talk with me in December. Event Day is his company. He's a startup. And basically, they do live event management. So in other words, imagine a conference like this, and they basically scan your code. The idea is you can go to their website, register. They store all the data in Azure for people that are registered. And then when you show up, you basically can print out ahead of time a code, or you just show them your details. And then they basically log you in, and then they connect a printer to Azure. And so as soon as you hit sign in on, say, a mobile phone, it outprints your actual badge that's personalized, as well as your personalized schedule if you set it up online there. And so it's a cool startup you can check out. But they take advantage of printing from Azure. And so it's actually, it is pretty common that people want to actually activate stuff. And the service bus makes it really easy to kind of connect on-premise with Azure. And you can do demand and printing as a result from that. Yeah?
We are currently trying to use VirtualConnect.
It's a good question. So he's currently using Virtual Connect or Azure Connect to do printing. And you probably can do that. So for people that probably don't know what Azure Connect is, one of the things I showed in my Azure talk was how you bridge, actually, let me do the version I had this morning, how to bridge kind of public and private things. So in other words, I might have the internet between my local network at the bottom and an app at the top. How do I actually connect the two? Azure basically has two mechanisms that you can use for that. One is something we call Azure Connect, which effectively lets you set up a virtual private network or a network connection between your Azure apps and certain and roles and your private network. And that's kind of like if you were setting up a branch office for your company or if you're using VPN or RASing in to your corporate environment from home. So it's a network that's open. You know, you're kind of locked down at the network level as to what you can do. But it tends to be fairly broad in terms of what you can do because you can basically... You could print, but you could also, hey, maybe there's a file server on that machine as well. Maybe I could access that. And so one thing you want to be careful of if you open up your network too broad is that you might inadvertently, if your app is compromised elsewhere, end up allowing someone to get into your network. And so in general, what we kind of recommend is lock down that virtual connection as much as possible. And that's true for branch offices as well. One nice thing about Service Bus is that instead of opening it up to everything, you can control and just say, hey, I just want to allow printing, this one set of commands with these three operations. That's the only thing I want to open up and allow between the cloud and my local network, which gives you a lot more security because hackers will have a harder time trying to exploit that. And so you might want to consider for a printing scenario just actually using a service bus queue or a relay to actually connect the two. Because then you could have much more fine-grained operations. You have to write code for that, whereas with the virtual private network, you can just plug in the printer. But it's not that much code, and it gives you a lot of security and scalability if you do that.
And there are some suppliers like HP with web printing.
Yep.
So there's an authentication code, and then you can print from any device to your printer.
Yep.
Any chance that you can integrate that with?
Yeah, so the nice thing about the web API stuff that I showed in the MVC front is it works on the server, but there's also a corresponding client-side API that I didn't get a chance to show today that allows you to easily make web API calls from any type of .NET app, including a Metro Windows 8 app, to a remote REST service. And it doesn't have to be implemented with ASP.NET. It could just be a standard API. And so you should be able to take the HTTP client library that comes with web API and talk to the HTTP the Hewlett-Packard print API and enable that to work as well. So, yeah, you should just be able to call that within Azure, I believe, pretty easily. And we are integrating OAuth support inside the web API, both server and client. And if people don't know, OAuth is kind of a pretty popular open security mechanism. And most of the web APIs that have authentication or authorization use some type of OAuth-based approach. So we're trying to make that really easy to use. Other Azure questions, can you deploy multiple sites into a single web role? So in other words, rather than have a single server with a single app, could I have 10 sites on a single server? The answer is yes, you can do that. It's not as easy as I'd like today, but you can do that. Basically, what you do is, let me see if I can find my first red shirt project, which I think was this morning. Red shirt? Or was it red shirt 2? It was red shirt 2. So basically, within your solution here, I have an ASP.NET app here. Within my role, I didn't have roles. What you can do is you can go into your what's called service definition file, and there's a site section, and you can basically have multiple bindings. And so you could set up multiple host names inside here and basically control where it goes on disk. Where it's not as nice is it doesn't currently integrate as cleanly into the project solution format that we use inside VS. You're going to see some updates to make multi-site web hosting easier later this year. But you can absolutely enable it within a web role today. Yeah?
If you specify a physical directory, it just copies the directory. So there's no action built.
Correct, yeah. So if you wanted, for example, a common thing here also is, let's say, for your site, you could actually... I remember the syntax here. You can create, for example, a virtual directory. So oftentimes, let's say you have a bunch of images, you could actually register a virtual directory called slash images, and it doesn't have to be part of your VS project. Instead, you could have it point to blob storage or something like that, and so you could use this config file to specify that as well. Have you done that recently?
Yeah.
Huh.
Last week.
Send me mail. It should. You said the inner site. So you're saying not the one in your project. You mean the directory you pointed to.
Yeah,
that probably... So when I mentioned the project integration is not as tight as I'd like, it's things like that. You'll see us make that simpler in the future, though.
Okay.
Yeah. We're going to... Yeah. With some good stuff coming. Yeah. Yeah, so you'll be able to pool apps on a VM a little bit easier. Yeah, so that more integration is coming. Again, you can make it work, but you have to kind of do some config file and build scripts to do it. But you'll see some cleaner integration coming soon. Other questions? Are there? Okay. Can you deploy Windows services in the background of web roles? The answer is yes. So basically. Within Azure, we have a couple of different concepts you can use. One is this concept of roles. So in other words, this project I built has one role currently called Redshirt 2. If I wanted to, I could create what's called a worker role, or I could have multiple web roles, but I could create a worker role. I could call this my background stuff. So this will add another project into my solution. And if I double-click on here... This is very much like a command line console, except it's not a command line console. It basically is a run method. It gets fired, and you can do anything you want inside this run method. And the way this works is this will deploy right now to a second VM that's separate from my web role. As an example, I could deploy a service layer inside my worker role and have my front end call it. So I could have WCF here, and I could have ASP.NET here. Within your project, I can, for each one, control the size of the VM and the number of instances that I'm running. And so this is kind of an easy way that if you have a multi-tier app or a multi-server app, you can create roles, different projects for each, and you can kind of manage them. And when you run this at runtime locally, it'll spin up the emulator. Yeah. Whatever. Something with that keyboard thing, I'm still trying to figure out what's going on. I think an OS reboot's in my future. But basically, the emulator will allow you to have multiple of those running, and you can basically configure run those. And so now I have two worker roles, but I could have three worker roles in the back end, I could have two front ends, etc. So this is a way, if you want to run effectively what you typically do today with an NT service or a Windows service, this provides kind of a nice way that you could go ahead and abstract that code and do kind of non-UI interactive tasks and run it. Now, this default approach I just showed will actually separate out your back-end code from your front-end code into separate VMs. So that's good in terms of scalability and isolation, but if you want to maximize your costs or minimize your costs, it's a good way to maximize your costs, but if you want to minimize your costs, the downside is you're going to have more VMs than you might want or need. And so one other thing that you can do, which is kind of nice, is instead of actually having a worker role, you can create what's called a startup task within your web role. And in the startup task, it fires even before the global.asax. It allows you to customize the VM however you want. And what a lot of people do is they'll kick off a background task or a background NT service or a background command line console app, and they'll actually do the background processing on the web role itself. And that way, you only have to pay for one role, and you can minimize your costs. So that is supported as well. And you can do some weird and wacky stuff in your startup tasks. Yeah?
We are doing the same, but we don't want to have any... we want each project separate, so we want to have the web project and the Windows service project completely separate, so we don't want to include any files from the Windows server into the web project.
Yep.
So, because all the examples are that you copy or reference the Windows service into the web project, and then in the startup task, we will install the UGL, and then there it is.
Well, what you can do in this, so the question is, how do you keep the code separate so you don't have to have the background logic in the web role? What you should be able to do in your startup task is, as part of your build task, you should be able to pull the output from one project, deploy it as part of your web role, and then the startup task just executes it. And so effectively, think of, you know, a command line console project that implements a class library, and then your startup task effectively just loads the library and executes it. And that would allow you to keep the code separate, and you should be able to automate that. Send me mail, and we can I can hook you up with someone if you have trouble getting that working. That actually, ironically, was something I asked them to write a tutorial on last week. So so hopefully we'll have a tutorial that shows up how to do that soon, too. How to have two roles talk to each other in Azure. So I think the question was around web services and load balancing, and how does that all work? I don't have a graphic that describes it, but basically, I have another graphic I can try to use. Basically, when you run an application, I showed this here, and I have two web roles running. Imagine I had two worker roles running here as well. I then expose it on the internet. Basically, when you deploy an app in Azure, or what we call a service in Azure, when we register with Azure, the way the load balancer works is that we give you what's called a virtual IP address, or VIP. It's an IP address that it's like 124.7.7.8 or something. And so you can point anything on the internet at it. So you can register a DNS entry as like, I think it's an A name it's called. So a first class entry, and point at that virtual IP address. And as long as you have something deployed in Azure, we will preserve that IP address just for you. Anytime you access a resource through that IP address, you will go through the load balancer. So if you have, your app basically calls back to itself and it says, myapp.com/foo, you will go through the load balancer to get back to yourself, which is not going to be as efficient as going directly to the box. You'll do one extra network hop. And so it'll add, not that much, but I think it's about, for the L2, probably about 0.35 milliseconds on top of your network call. What you can optionally do instead is we have a class inside Azure called the role environment class. And so, for example, here, you can say role environment dot. And this will give you some extra information around what's running inside your app. And it has, I think over through roles, or current role instance, you can get information, for example, about what your IP address is and all those things. And you can also, I believe, go through the roles guy here and say, you can iterate through all the roles running in your app, and you can get direct IP address endpoints from it. If you want to have, say, your front end talk to your back end, so your web role talking to your worker role, what you probably want to do as part of your startup, as part of your app, is just maintain a list of, here's actually the private IP address of that box. And then when I call it, I won't go through the load balancer. I go directly to that box. And there's change. There's events that you can handle on the role environment so that if things change, like roles get added or are removed, you can handle that and basically recalculate the list of boxes you should go for. So if you want to do advanced instance-to-instance communication, the role environment class gives you what you need to do it. We'll also fire events. So, for example, if we're about to patch your machine, we'll fire an event saying, hey, we're going to shut you down in 10 minutes or 5 minutes, just give you a heads up. And so if you're like a database role, you could start swapping out your data or transition the data to another role, and then we'll bring your machine down, patch it, bring it back up. And so you get access to that type of information. It's pretty powerful. It's kind of advanced scenarios, but it's all powered and exposed. Strategy for workflow. So we have a bunch of improvements coming with .NET 4.5 for workflow, including a lot of enhancements on the workflow designer, a lot of work around activities, and a lot of extensibility that's been added in. If you have specific questions, send me mail. I'd be happy to connect you with the workflow team. They work for me now. Our strategy with workflow is to kind of enable you to do workflows easier and better and faster, which is the strategy for most of our stuff. But specifically with workflow, one of the things that we are focusing on, though, is how do we enable you, in particular for large apps and for what we call ISVs that are building apps to sell to others, how can they provide extensibility within their apps using workflow? And so we see a lot of scenarios where someone's building an enterprise app that they want to resell, and they want to allow the person that's buying it to very easily use the workflow designer inside Visual Studio, or potentially a custom workflow designer that they embed with their application so that the company can actually orchestrate things and run them in a clean way. And so you'll see us do a lot of things with that. Workflow is used with SharePoint today. You'll see some improvements along those lines with workflow and other apps in the future. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I'd say send me mail on the designer side, and I can put you in touch with the workflow team, and they'd love to talk with you and work with you on that. What you can also do is with workflow, someone asked me in my Azure talk, can you host workflow inside Azure today? Absolutely yes. The worker role that I showed creating here, which has this run method, you could very easily use the workflow hosting APIs to basically host the workflow engine, and then you could run any custom workflow you want inside that worker role. You can absolutely use workflow inside Azure in addition to obviously running on Windows Server on-premise. Future of Silverlight and XAML. So we just shipped Silverlight 5 end of November, beginning of December. Silverlight 5 has a bunch of great features in it, and pretty much all the features that we talked about kind of December last year in it, supported on all the same operating systems, all the same browsers that we have. And since a lot of people have asked, hey, what's the future investment of Silverlight? One of the things we explicitly did as part of the Silverlight 5 release was to try to be clear it has a minimum of a 10-year lifecycle agreement. So we'll be supporting it and fixing bugs with it for the next 10 years. So we haven't talked about future features, but we wanted to try to be clear in terms of, since a lot of people were asking, they know that it's going to work, and it's a good release that just came out, and we're really excited about that. In terms of overall investments in XAML, I'd say the thing that we've focused more on the last couple of years, this is true really going back 2 years, as we've kind of seen more and more devices come out, I see like 4 different types of phones and devices in the front row alone. If you want the broadest possible reach, we do think, HTML inside a browser is going to give you the broadest reach. If you want to run on a Kindle and on an Android and on iOS and a Windows Phone and a Windows Slate, and so we are investing heavily in HTML both server side and client side. If you want to build the richest possible experience, we think you're going to build a native app for those devices. And we think a lot of people are going to want to build native apps for devices because that gives you the best possible experience. And so one of the things we are also doing in the XAML stack has been focusing on how do we enable you to use XAML to build really rich apps on a bunch of platforms. And so we started that with Windows Phone and the Windows Phone 7 app experience, which is based on XAML and Silverlight. There's some great talks here that walk through building Metro apps using XAML for Windows 8. And so you'll be able to use the same kind of, or this, roughly the same Metro design language for both phone and for tablets and for clients with Windows 8. The last two with Windows 8, the first one with Windows Phone. And you'll be able to use XAML, C#, and your core .NET skills for that as well. And so in that case there, you are going to tailor it differently for different devices to take more advantage of the app targets. But we think for people that have XAML knowledge, whether in particular Silverlight but also WPF, it allows you to reuse code, certainly allows you to reuse your skills and knowledge and tools and hopefully be able to reach those types of devices as well. And so I do think you're going to see XAML focus more on how do we enable you to build the richest possible experiences on certain devices. Silverlight in the browser obviously will give you broad reach for both Mac and Windows within the browser. But I think you also see XAML continue investment and focus more on how do you build the richest possible experiences on the actual native apps and native build native apps on devices. So I don't know if that was a long-winded answer. And all the server stuff I showed today in terms of web APIs, obviously you can call from within Silverlight. And part of the goal with web APIs in general from a server perspective is you can have any type of client call them, whether it's Silverlight, WPF, Win32, Android with Java, iOS with Objective-C, HTML inside the browser, Metro apps with XAML, Metro apps with HTML. I'm sure I'm missing a couple. But you know, it gives you an example. You can design for any of those on the server side and reach maximum targets. Whew, what does the future of the world look like in 5 years? Good question. I'm going to take the positive spin on what the world could look like. Hopefully the world in general looks better, there's no more debt crisis, I hope, in 5 years. But in terms of what the future of the technology world looks like, I think it's going to be pretty exciting. I don't entirely know what it's going to look like, but I do think it's going to be pretty exciting from a developer's perspective and from a user's perspective in terms of what you can do. I think a couple trends that I'd call out that I think are interesting. One is you just think back 5 years from now, none of us had smartphones, or the smartphones we had are kind of a pale shadow of what we have today. We didn't have tablets. Touch was kind of something that not really happened. Our TVs weren't connected. The amount that's changed in terms of devices has really just exploded. Part of the reason why in my NBC talk I focused a lot on the web APIs is, as we see this explosion of devices, I think there's a huge opportunity to start integrating those with data, to start integrating those with back-end systems, and do even more with those types of devices. And I think the devices are going to get richer, and I think the back-ends are going to get richer. Obviously, with .NET and VS, we want to make sure that you can build both really rich. But I do think it's going to be interesting from the number of different types of form factors and the number of different types of devices out there. I think connectivity is going to skyrocket. I think 4G increasingly, or equivalent LTE, I guess, equivalents around the world, 2 or 3 years from now, we'll all take for granted in the same way we take 3G for granted. And in a world where you can download and upload things really fast, and we're always connected, there's going to be an awful lot of usages of the network and the back end. And part of the reason why I'm excited about the cloud and working on the cloud is, from a server perspective, I think you're going to see a lot more usage of the cloud as people want to be able to support all these different types of devices out there and all this increased connectivity. And so as much as storing petabytes of data sounds like something you never, ever do, the reality is a lot of us have apps that store petabytes of data, And a lot of us are going to exchange data between apps that store petabytes of data. And the fact that we as developers can just push a button and get access to that, I think is really, A, liberating, and B, means that you could build even better apps that you can do than you could before. And so a lot of what you'll see with Azure over the next couple of years is more and more back-end services that enable you to do more and more scenarios. I think another trend you're going to see a lot of is kind of data as a first-class concept really explode. I asked today how many people use a database, and everyone raised their hand. But if you think about what you store with data and what your corporate apps are doing with data, I think you'll see a lot more in the next couple of years with it, and that in that it's become cheap enough, the sort of trend where the cost of storage has plummeted over the last 10 or 15 years, that you can actually store almost anything and extract value out of it enough to actually store it forever. And by that I mean, take all of our badges. I'll go back to my hotel today and probably throw this away because I have like five other badges from this trip already. Whereas, hey, maybe it makes sense for me to scan this with a PDF reader and stick it somewhere in blob storage because maybe someday I can actually get some value out of this. And you might say, what in the world could I get value out of this? Well, there's shapes, there's information, there's a barcode. I don't know what value I can get, but this is going to cost me less than a penny to store, for the next decade. Why not store it? And I think the interesting thing is as storage has gotten cheaper and as computers have gotten cheaper, we're going to be able to start writing programs that can actually look at stuff like this 10 years from now and actually probably get some unique value out of it, at least enough to justify the fraction of a penny it's going to cost me to store it. And the number of types of apps and the types of experiences, I think, we're going to start to change, and I think you're going to see a lot of tools from us and others for how you get insights from data in unique ways. So I'll show you something that, is this being like recorded on the web? Yeah, great. I'll show you something really quick that, I shouldn't show. But what is a example of sort of some of the stuff. We'll show it. So one of the things that, just an example of data, my team's kind of been pushing quite a bit is, how do you make data-driven decisions and look at data and actually extract value from it? And so for our website that we launched in December, one of the things that we did was we basically instrumented it really well so that we can, every day when you hit the site, if you all hit it right now, you will all get a slightly different version of the site. Because we're constantly playing around with different strings, different texts, different things. And we basically measure to see what actually drives behavior. So in other words, should it be called Explore the Features, which it is in this screen? Should it be called Take the Tour? Or should it be called Learn More? Who wants to take a vote as to, so if we hit refresh 10 times, you might get 10 different versions of this. Those three options that I specified, anyone want to actually vote, guess on what is the most common in terms of option, in terms of driving business? Like, what will actually make the most money? Explore the food. Okay. Everyone, third, learn more. Features. Take the tour. Yeah. The reality is we don't have a clue, right? When we sat down in December and designed the website, we had no idea either. So we actually went with take the tour. So that was what we call our control. What we actually found was, Explore the Features, someone guessed, is 10.57. Actually drives like an extra 1,500 people to sign up for the product every week. And Learn More, which is actually what I was telling the team they should do in December, actually decreases traffic than what we actually went with. Another couple examples here. Here's one. So on the free trial page that you click here, we have a button, and we talk about why you should sign up and try it free and all that stuff. So basically, we had sign up now, get it now, try it free. How many extra customers a week do you think we get, depending on the different option? Just that one string. Try it free. That's you're right, because that's actually what we went with. it's 5,000 extra customers a week, which is, you know, it's actually almost $100 million of revenue a year. So it's that one string is actually worth changing. But we had no idea when we actually went live with it. But we kind of measured it. The last one I'll show, which is, I think, the most interesting. Two versions of the website. One that has no logos. The other one has a logos of big companies, billion-dollar companies that bet on Azure. And you click them and you go to a case study. And so we basically said, which of these two pages would actually cause big enterprise customers and people that want to bet on Azure more? Guess? And what the percentage would be? Yeah, someone said less is more. So if you want to sign up big enterprise customers, you say don't make any claims that anyone uses your product. You might, yeah, so you're probably wondering, okay, now there's the catch, so I don't know. So yeah, so basically we went live with the control here, and we basically assumed that if you put big names of big international companies that have billions of dollars of revenue that are betting on your product, that more people would like to use your product because they get some assurance from that, right? It turns out that if you don't have that, our revenue goes up. And so if we actually don't claim anyone uses our product, more people are willing to actually use the product than if we actually have internationally brand recognized Global 100 names.
I think you need big names to sell it.
It's kind of weird. Basically, we think what it is basically if you give people choices, they often go, I don't know what to pick, so they just close the browser. It's completely unintuitive. Like when they said, I went to the page and I went, where are the logos? And they said, we're trying without the logos. And I said, you idiots, or something kind of like that. And they said, well, give us 4 days and we'll tell you the statistical numbers. And they came back and they said, oh, our revenue goes up 15% when we actually don't have it. And I said, okay, you're geniuses, or something like that. And, as an example. And so this is an example of kind of being data-driven. We instrument everything, every change we make on the page, on the site. We do before and after. We do what's called cohort analysis. So when we test it, we actually test it so that an equal number of people in a given minute see both options. Because if you test in the morning and the afternoon, you get all these weird skews. If you test on the weekend during the day or during the weekday, you get very different data. And so we try to make sure, you know, the same number of people from the Netherlands that hit the site see A and B, and we know precisely what the difference is. Eventually, you know, we'll do things like, you know, are they customers already or not, and do even more precise. But if you have that data and you store that data, you can actually get huge insights from that data, and this is sort of a simple example of a couple of those. And often it's completely unintuitive insights. And we do enough, we don't just look at a minute, we look at a couple days' worth, so we have a statistically significant number so that we know it's not just weird random people in a given hour. But one of the things I think you'll see with the cloud and with the changes is that because we can store a lot more data and because we can spin up servers to analyze that data much faster, the way we build apps and the more data-driven our apps will become a lot more. And so one feature we have in Azure we've already announced is called a managed Hadoop service. And so that does something called MapReduce. And so what you can do is you can store lots of petabytes of data or terabytes or gigabytes of data. And then if you want to run a job to, say, look at the data and produce insights, you can write a simple algorithm in C#, VB, C++, JavaScript, whatever language you want. And we'll split it out, run it across any number of servers you want us to, look at subsets of the data on each server, and then we basically coalesce it and give you an answer. And that starts to be really powerful because you can start to look at anything really fast and get insights. And I think that's going to be interesting for all of us as developers to think about. And look at. Yeah.
About looking at large data and the combination of Silverlight in your story, what happened with the you got called some kind of tooling was kind of a pivot viewer built in Silverlight.
Yep.
And it made very, on a great way, visualized a large amount of data and in a visual way with images and things like that.
Yeah, it's built into Silverlight 5. There's actually a feature, Pivot Viewer, I think is what we called it, Pivot Control, Power Pivot. The marketing guys get into it and at the end, and who knows what it's called. But Power Pivot, PP. And basically allows you to kind of visualize things and do kind of image manipulation and really powerful visualization. One of the things to look at with the new version of SQL Server that's coming out, codenamed Denali, They're using Silverlight 5, and they have the most amazing business intelligence dashboard of all time. And it allows you to do really, really interesting insights. I'm not going to tell the exact story because it's private. But we had a customer that came in, and they said, hey, we want to know if your BI is any good. And we did actually a bake-off where they gave us like hundreds of gigabytes of insight. And they wanted to kind of just run through the data. And we did a demo for them and said, oh, look, you know, here's some insights you can get. And they were trying to actually understand something about their business. And they kind of had an assumption of, hey, is it A or B? And as they were doing it, they're drilling in. They said, wait a second, that isn't right. And they stepped back. And they found a completely different insight about their business that just blew their minds. And they had the data, but they couldn't see it. They couldn't figure it out. And I think as much as like MapReduce and spinning up servers on top of data with algorithms is going to help, I think it's going to be the next generation of tools that are above that help you get the insights and find the insights where the real proposition is. And I think you'll see that over the next couple of years. And we hope they're ours. But the nice thing about Azure is you can use any of them and you can build your own. In Hibernate or any framework. Yeah, I think they're both great. I mean, I think Entity Framework started out less great in its first release. I think it's come a long way. The Entity Framework team actually doesn't work for me and has never worked for me, so I'm not just trying to be nice. But I think I actually really like EF Code First. I think the migration stuff that I showed today, personally, I would use Entity Framework if I was starting a project. And I'm not just saying that because I'm biased and I'm Microsoft Corporate Vice President. But I do think Entity Framework now, from a productivity perspective and from a feature perspective, is getting to a good sweet spot. In Hibernate, it has a lot of really advanced features and a huge active community. And so I don't think betting on In Hibernate is wrong at all. And so if you have In Hibernate, great. I wouldn't move from it. But I do think Entity Framework has probably gotten to the point where a lot of the dissat that was there before have gone. And I think the productivity, they've done a really good job of kind of hitting flexibility with really nice productivity out of the box. What does VS 11 look like? I consciously did not install VS 11 on my machine, so I don't know. Actually, I do know. But I don't know. Each release, we changed the style on VS 11. So we did for VS 10, we did for VS 2008, we did for VS 2005. And so we will be changing styles and things with VS 11. In terms of specifics, we haven't shipped yet, so we're also most likely still going to iterate on it. I think the VS team will probably share more of details of that.
Can you now ask one question? You can get your own theme for Visual Studio?
Yeah. Yeah, there are certain, the history of that is actually, so one of the things you can do is you can go to the extension gallery in VS today and you can swap your theme in VS. And the gentleman here was asking, hey, there's some things in VS you can't swap the theme for. Basically, the stuff you can't swap the theme for are the parts that aren't written in WPF yet. And pretty much everything you can theme, you're using the WPF extensibility mechanism to do it. There are still parts for historical reasons inside VS that are implemented in Win32. And those tend to be the parts where either the theme doesn't match quite right or it's not as extensible. In each release, VS 10 in particular, we made a big bet on WPF. VS 11 goes even further. I don't actually know the extensibility, whether the solution explorer is or not, fortunately. Can I share the secrets Ben said he couldn't share? I actually don't know what his secrets are. And even if I did, I probably couldn't say. So unfortunately not, but hopefully I've shared some secrets today. You probably can't tell which. But I do think there's some really exciting stuff coming out in the phone space. We talked a little bit about Windows 8 Metro and demoed that in the keynote this morning. Hopefully there's a lot of really exciting stuff coming in the future. And I hope to be back here again at Tech Days at some point. Hopefully before the next 5 years. We can figure out which of those future things have already come true and which might still happen. So thanks a bunch. I think I'm out of time. If you have more questions, fire away. Cool.